Well, let me just begin by saying it's a real honor to have been connected with the book for so long, to have assisted you in producing it and be involved in these conversations. And I think I probably speak for many people in the audience in saying, it's a unique kind of book. It gives a unique voice to an issue, the kind of question of eating animals and factory farming that many people have written on. And I think one of the things that makes it different is that you're a novelist. You're a storyteller, instead of being a lawyer or a journalist or a scientist, as other kinds of people who have been more commonly written on this issue. And you open and close the book with a chapter called Storytelling. And I'm wondering if I could ask you to read a bit from the opening chapter. Give you some page numbers. On page 16 and 17, and what I'm wondering if you could speak to after you take a look at that is how does being a novelist help us think about this issue? How does story help us think about this issue? Why does story matter when we're fighting something as technological as factory farming?
Well, first of all, thank you for coming, and thank you, Aaron, for agreeing to do this. I've known Aaron for 10 years, something like that. And whenever I introduce him to somebody, or when he's not present and I'm speaking about him, I will often say, oh, Aaron is the smartest person I know. And it must be true because you're not there. So there's no reason to lie about it. But Aaron was really indispensable in writing this book. And, there's one of the things that I try to convey in the book is the complexity of the subject. And it's certainly not comprehensively served with a 300-page book, and it wouldn't be comprehensively served with a 3,000-page book, or a book at all. And that's, I think, one of the things we'll talk about as we talk about storytelling, is to really do justice to the complexity and the significance of the subject, one has to also know the story of the person that you're speaking with, and you have to share your own story. And so Aaron helped me understand that while also bringing this enormous volume of just sheer information to me in a way that I could digest. And that will be the last accidental food pun of the evening. So storytelling. So I opened the book by talking about these weekends I would spend at my grandmother's house. My grandmother was a Holocaust survivor and a kind of, if she weren't real, she would be unbelievable. Or people would, if she were, I've tried many times to write about her in the context of fiction, and it often feels like caricature. But I hope it didn't feel that way in this book. When I was growing up, I would often spend weekends at her house, and those weekends took place almost entirely around her kitchen table. And we would play Uno, the card game, and we would eat sort of the same foods over and over and over, and I would hear the same stories over and over. And one of them is the story that I begin the book with, only the end of which will I tell now. So she says, speaking about the time that she was moving east across Europe, away from Poland, where she was born, through Russia. She says, then it all changed. During the war, it was hell on earth, and I had nothing. I left my family. I was always running day and night because the Germans were always right behind me. If you stopped, you died. There was never enough food. I became sicker and sicker from not eating. And I'm not just talking about being skin and bones. I had sores all over my body. It became difficult to move. I wasn't too good to eat from a garbage can. I ate the parts that others wouldn't eat. If you helped yourself, you could survive. I took whatever I could find. I ate things that I wouldn't tell you about. The worst it got was right near the end. A lot of people died right at the end. And I didn't know if I could make it another day. A farmer, a Russian, he saw my condition and he went into his house and he came out with a piece of meat for me. He saved your life, I said. Oh, I didn't eat it, she said. You didn't eat it? It was pork. I wouldn't eat pork. Why? What do you mean, why? What, because it wasn't kosher? Of course. But not even to save your life. And she said, if nothing matters, there's nothing to save. And so I wanted to open the book with that. It's a kind of curious way to open a book about factory farming in America, because for a few reasons. One, that this idea that, you know, the decisions that we make in a grocery store or when perusing a menu in a restaurant or when cooking for ourselves or for our children or for friends have ultimately very little to do with caloric intake and very much to do with our ideas about who we are and who we want to be, what kind of culture we inhabit, what identity we have or want to have, whether it is religious or cultural or just geographic, whether we think of ourselves as healthy or want to, whether we think of ourselves as foodies or want to. And I think these are ideas that are very, very easy to forget, but certain things make us remember them. Being with my grandmother made me remember them, and becoming a father really made me remember them in a way that, remember might be the wrong word, because I experienced them with an intensity that I hadn't ever before. So I wanted this book in an attempt to do justice to the complexity of the subject to contain stories, because they have so much to do with the decisions that we make, or they ought to. But also that line that she ended on, if nothing matters, there's nothing to save, became the kind of premise of the book. You know, this idea that everyone draws many lines in the sand in the course of one's life and in the course of every day, and we draw the lines in different places, but the lines are quite important to us, you know, even if they have been like trodden over so much that we can't see them anymore, that our senses of ourselves, almost like we cut the silhouettes of ourselves, of our identities, by the things that we don't do. You know, I am somebody who doesn't steal. I am somebody who doesn't talk to my children in a certain way. I am somebody who doesn't fight in a war I don't believe in. I'm somebody who doesn't tell white lies. I'm somebody who doesn't buy Apple products. Like, everyone has a version, you know? It's kind of a curious list I just assembled, but so the question is, what are the lines that we draw, and how do we remember them, and how do we live inside of these worlds that are so demanding of us while still maintaining like the perimeter of the definition of our identities? So, you know, oftentimes I make a point of going to a lot of high schools to talk about this subject because it's fun, first of all, because high school students are so frank with their opinions. Also because it's where change happens. You know, it's been very well documented that the older you get, the less dramatic change is possible in one's life. And I get talked back to a lot. And I always love trying to engage the person who talks back the most, who's most dismissive. And so one way that I engage them in conversation is I say, would you pay $5 for the best hamburger in the world? And the person always says yes. Would you pay $10 for the best hamburger in the world? Sure. Would you pay $100 for the best hamburger in the world? I probably would. Would you pay $100,000 for the best hamburger in the world? And nobody says yes. I say, okay, so there is a price that is too much. Like, there is something that, there's a line that you wouldn't cross. In this case, a financial line. And then you can walk backwards from that and try to find the person's financial limit. And then you can say, would you eat a hamburger if you knew that the animal was raised indoors instead of outdoors? Probably. Would you eat a hamburger if you knew the animal never got to spend time doing sort of species-specific behaviors, like being with its mother or being in a social group? Maybe. Would you eat a hamburger if you knew that the animal experienced its own slaughter over the course of 15 minutes? And you will find a place, however far you have to go. Everybody has a place where they will say, no, that's too much for me. So first of all, just recognizing the fact that everybody has a place that is too much for them speaks volumes to this issue, right? There has never been a person in human history, I believe, who has been completely laissez-faire to the question of eating animals. Everybody has some degree of sensitivity to it. Everybody has some recognition of the fact that a thing of importance is happening when you raise an animal to and kill an animal in order to eat it. So just starting with that idea that we agree that there is a kind of meat we wouldn't eat is a very powerful starting point, and then walking it back to, well, what is the limit? And that finding what that limit is requires hearing what the person's story is, you know, what kind of access they have to other kinds of foods, what kind of foods their parents serve them, how they think about the role of food in their daily lives. If it's something that, you know, a lot of people eat to get full, some people eat as like a near religious experience. So the more time I have found this to be not only consistently true, but uniformly true, that the more time I spend talking with somebody, the more agreement we find ourselves to, you know, to be in. I believed when I started writing this book, and it's been confirmed to me since it was published, that everybody agrees on the subject of eating animals, despite the fact that it seems to be such an incredibly divisive issue. Everybody is in agreement. It's just a question of how we talk about that agreement and how we talk about what our practical daily lives will look like when we act on this agreement. The agreement being that it is wrong to have a food system that is more destructive to the environment than everything else put together. It's wrong to have a food system that's unnecessarily cruel to animals. You know, who are the people that would disagree with this? You can't even conjure the person in your mind. The, you know, 96% of Americans think that animals deserve legal protection from cruelty. 76% of Americans believe that farmed animals deserve strict protections from cruelty. I would challenge anyone in this room to think of something that 76% of Americans agree on. 76% of Americans don't agree that the earth is round, you know? That is not only a broad consensus, it's broad to the point of sounding universal. And there are some people who believe that global warming is not happening. There are people who believe that global warming has nothing to do with human causes. Everybody agrees that the quality of air we breathe matters. You cannot conceive of the person who would disagree with that. Everybody agrees that the quality of water that we drink matters. So when we can have a calm conversation that doesn't feel like a wagging finger, but feels like an exchange of stories, personal stories, an aspirational story about who we want to be and what we want the world to look like, people start to agree. It's not to say that people are going to become vegetarian at the end of that story, because they're not, by and large. But you're going to find an awful lot of people eating largely vegetarian.
Now, one of the things that's, I think, maybe made us draw lines differently these days is companion animals, maybe dogs in particular. There's this special kind of connection we have with them, and it's kind of hard not to think a little bit about the affection we have for our dog when we're thinking about how we want farm animals to be treated. And, you know, in addition to featuring your human family in here, you talk about your dog, George. And you make quite a bit of it. I'm wondering if you could read a bit from the passage here where you kind of meet George, and maybe say something about companion animals, the animals we spend time with. How do they help us tell these stories differently? And I'm thinking maybe the passage beginning on page 23 would be a valuable one to take a look at.
Right. So I used to be really afraid of dogs, really deathly afraid of dogs. And then we got a dog. Without my having gotten over my fear, it just, I don't know, we saw this dog who was up for adoption on the street, and there was something, it felt inevitable, or I don't know what, but we came home with a dog. And, you know, at first, I really had to learn how to, George, I should say, is a girl, how to approach her to get over that instinct that something bad might happen, namely, you know, an attack. And then I became, you know, they say that converts make the greatest zealots. Like, I really became a dog person in an extreme way. And so, you know, I was the first time I became a vegetarian was when I was 9. This was long before I got a dog, so it wouldn't be right to say that having a companion animal in any way made me think about these things for the first time, but it did make me think about them differently. So I'll read a little passage about having George. It wouldn't be right to say that my relationship with George has revealed to me the sagacity of animals. Beyond her most basic desires, I don't have the faintest clue what's going on in her head, although I've become convinced that much beyond basic desires is going on. I'm surprised by her lack of intelligence as often as I'm surprised by her intelligence. The differences between us are always more present than the similarities. And George isn't a kumbaya being who only wants to give and receive affection. As it turns out, she's a major pain in the ass an awful lot of the time. She compulsively pleasures herself in front of guests, eats my shoes and my son's toys, is monomaniacally obsessed with squirrel genocide, has the savant-like ability to find her way between... I haven't read this in so long, but it's so true. Has the savant-like ability to find her way between the camera lens and the subject of every photo taken in her vicinity, lunges at skateboarders and chassids, humiliates menstruating women, and is the worst nightmare of menstruating chassids, backs her flatulent ass into the least interested person in the room, digs up the freshly planted, scratches the newly bought, licks the about to be served, and occasionally exacts revenge for what? By shitting in our house. Our various struggles to communicate, to recognize and accommodate each other's desires, simply to coexist, force me to encounter and interact with something, or rather someone, entirely other. George can respond to a handful of words and choose to ignore a slightly larger handful, but our relationship takes place almost entirely outside of language. She seems to have thoughts and emotions. Sometimes I think I understand them, but often I don't. Like a photograph, she cannot say what she lets me see. She's an embodied secret, and I must be a photograph to her.
So what? How do companion animals change the way we should see this? As you pointed out, you began to think about this and reflect critically on it before. What do our companion animals do?
Well, I think there's no cure to indifference like exposure. You know, it's how, not even indifference, but suspicion or hatred. They're often born out of a lack of exposure. It's not a coincidence that as popular culture has embraced first, let's say, strong women, and then African Americans, and then gay couples, that and created a context of exposure for people who didn't, where they lived in their daily lives, have perhaps that exposure, that it begins to propel social change. And it can happen very, very quickly. So you just don't meet people with pets who deny that their pets have some kind of experience, some kind of first person, like a significant first person experience. I think people, I don't know how disingenuous it is, but people will, even in the year 2013, argue, as Descartes did, that like a farmed animal exhibits pain but isn't experiencing pain, that it's a kind of automaton almost, that, you know, the pig squeals in a way that is very, very similar to how a human might squeal when trying to avoid pain. The pig makes extreme efforts to get away from suffering in the same way that a human might, and brain scans reveal that the neural activity of a pig in pain is remarkably similar to that of a human in pain, but it's not really the same thing. And in fact, it's different enough that we don't even need to regard it. Nobody feels that way about their pets. Nobody's indifferent to stepping on a dog's tail. And I don't think it's simply because the dog is yours. I think it's because you've had enough experience with it to know that that just couldn't possibly be true. It couldn't possibly be the case that it is showing us all of these signs that it has some kind of rich first-person experience, even if we won't ever be able to know what it is, and that, like us, the greatest drama of its life is to avoid pain. So one of the things that I write about in the book is this question of what do we do with our instincts about what animals might feel or experience when put against or placed beside the fact that we actually will never know, just as I will never know what you actually feel. You know, I have all sorts of reasons for believing that you feel certain things. Like when you slam your hand in a car door, I have a lot of reasons to believe that you are in pain. You're not just saying you are in pain. You're not just shaking your hand. You're not just, you know, having the neural firings that resemble those of mine when I am in pain. But the truth is I'll never know. And humans are really good at both making miserly assumptions about the pain of others and making generous assumptions about the pain of others. And so ultimately, the question of what is my dog like? Or at a more far extreme end, what is a salmon like? You know, fish tend to be the hardest to imagine ourselves into the minds of. Their pain is the easiest to disregard as just being kind of alien or different enough as to be unimportant to us. When we ask those questions, we're actually asking two questions. The first is about the referent, and the other is about ourselves. So when we ask about what is it like to be a dog, we're asking, what might that dog see and feel right now? Do dogs have thoughts? When dogs move their paws, when they're having dreams, what the hell would a dog dream about? Is the dream rich like ours? Does it contain psychology, or is it all just mentally reflexive? So we can ask questions about the dog, but we're also asking questions about ourselves. What kind of person do I want to be? Because I have a choice. Because there is no objective reality that we can all agree upon and report to, we don't know and we never will know. There is no way to know what it's like to be a dog. So suddenly there's a choice that we're presented with. Do I want to be somebody who assumes a lot or who assumes a little? And it's a very inspiring choice to be presented with, because it's exciting to be somebody who chooses to be generous with empathy and to be generous with our assumptions about others, you know, to believe that children are capable of real suffering, to believe that somebody who is in a coma hears you when you talk to them, to believe that, as humans have denied at many points in history, to believe that people of color feel things in a way that is perhaps not exactly the same, but you don't feel things in the way that's exactly the same, and my little brother doesn't feel things, but people feel things in ways that are enormously important to me. So this, again, I guess comes back to the idea of storytelling, is we're asking a question of what kind of story we want to tell about ourselves. What are the stakes? That's another unfortunate food pun. What are the stakes? You know, let's say the pig feels nothing and Descartes was right, and maybe factory farmers are right. Okay, so then I've missed an awful lot of good meals, you know? I have been too generous and I've missed an awful lot of good meals. But let's say the pig does feel something, or worse, let's say it feels a lot more than I am assuming. Well, then an industry that factory farms 50 billion animals every year, an industry that will keep pregnant pigs in cages so small they can't turn around, is a catastrophe on a scale that is actually hard to grasp.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point to kind of jump off from. If it is that, if we have this reality of 50 billion animals being treated in a way most of us would find unacceptable, it's, you know, kind of a difficult thing to digest. Oh my God, I just did that again. It's kind of hard not to. One of the things that's different...
It's a good thing the book wasn't about sex, because that's even harder. Case in point.
Well done. One of the things you you do in Eating Animals that's different from other books on food is you take on these big philosophical questions. And one of them is shame, which I think really speaks to what we were just talking about a moment ago, kind of looking out into the world and finding these things we really don't approve of. And I find the way you talk about, you know, shame very compelling. You do it in dialogue with, I know, a mutual kind of intellectual hero of ours, Franz Kafka. And there's a kind of famous, you know, famous meaning not very famous in this case, but famous story about Franz Kafka, about his vegetarianism. He became a vegetarian in the middle of his life, and apparently this happened at a moment when he was in Berlin looking at an aquarium. And he had kind of come to this decision that he wasn't going to eat animals, and he looked into the tank and he said, you know, now I can look at you in peace. I don't eat you anymore. And you relay this this story in the text and respond to it and kind of take on this issue of shame that you see behind it. Why is it, you know, I'd like you to read that passage and then maybe say something about why we should think about something like shame. It's kind of, you know, this old-fashioned word, this grand word. I'm thinking of page 37. How does that help us respond to something as tangible as the question of eating animals?
What had moved Kafka to become a vegetarian? And why is it a comment about fish that Max Brod records to introduce Kafka's diet? Surely Kafka also made comments about land animals in the course of becoming vegetarian. A possible answer lies in the connection that Benjamin makes, on the one hand, between animals and shame, and on the other, between animals and forgetting. Shame is the work of memory against forgetting. Shame is what we feel when we almost entirely, yet not entirely, forget social expectations and our obligations to others in favor of our immediate gratification. Fish, for Kafka, must have been the very flesh of forgetting. Their lives are forgotten in a radical manner that is much less common in our thinking about farmed land animals. Beyond this literal forgetting of animals by eating them, animal bodies were, for Kafka, burdened with the forgetting of all of those parts of ourselves that we want to forget. If we wish to disavow a part of our nature, we call it our animal nature. We then repress or conceal that nature. And yet, as Kafka knew better than most, we sometimes wake up and find ourselves still only animals. And this seems right. We do not, so to speak, blush with shame before fish. We can recognize parts of ourselves in fish, spines, pain receptors, endorphins that relieve pain, all the familiar pain responses, but then deny that these animal similarities matter, and thus equally deny important parts of our humanity. What we forget about animals, we begin to forget about ourselves. Today, at stake in the question of eating animals is not only our basic ability to respond to sentient life, but our ability to respond to parts of our own animal being. There's a war, not only between us and them, but between us and us. So I was really interested in this moment when Kafka says, I can look at you, to the fish. Now, obviously he knows that the fish can't hear him. Obviously he knows that fish don't speak English.
German, I think.
German fish don't, in any case. So it's an odd thing. Who exactly is he addressing? You know, is it one of those things like a prayer that a secular person might make, where simply saying it aloud gives it a kind of, brings it into an existence that it wouldn't have had only as a thought? Is he saying it to himself? I can look at you. I can look at myself. You know, but the idea of being able to look at something I found really powerful and continue to. The shame of having to avert one's eyes. You know, it's something that everybody's familiar with on a daily basis. Like the shame of a homeless person asking for money and choosing not to give the person money, or giving the person money and averting your eyes because you know that there's more than you can do than give the person a dollar. There's an incredible power in looking at something, especially when the something is yourself, but it's a very risky thing to do as well, because you risk having to either face your own hypocrisies or disappointments or the prospect of having to change your life. And it's one of the reasons that, despite the fact that everybody agrees about eating animals, in the ways that I described before, is very, very difficult to approach because we become so aware of that risk, so aware of the potential for shame, the shame of, you know, either you've had the experience or you've seen somebody have the experience of not wanting to see a film about a factory farm, and either you've had the experience or you've witnessed someone having the experience of not wanting to maybe read my book, because what you will always hear is, I know what that's going to say. I know what I'm going to see, and I don't want to.
Nobody in the audience has ever felt that way, I'm sure.
Yeah. I feel that way all the time about, you know, a lot of things. Charity in particular, you know. No, I mean, I'm serious. Like, one doesn't want to look at the brochures you get from charities because you have to face the shame of either acknowledging you just don't apparently care enough about it to do what is required of you, or the shame of willful forgetting, of feeling your eyes avert, you know. So shame, I think, is one of the most powerful motivators, ethical motivators. You know, it's been demonstrated that, or documented that, the great majority of people who become vegetarians because of animal welfare issues. You know, even though the environmental arguments are so persuasive, and the economic arguments, and the, you know, how farmers are treated, really from any perspective, it's a pretty persuasive argument. But the vast majority of people who become vegetarians because of animal welfare, because it inspires a very particular and strong kind of shame. The challenge is, most people are reluctant to be in a context that might inspire that kind of shame. So how do you bring them into it? You know, and I think it's with shame's counterpart, which is inspiration. Like, and they're very closely related. They're not opposites. Like, acting on one's shame makes one feel inspired. Like I was saying about having the choice to either be miserly or generous with your definition of suffering, it is inspiring. It feels good to say, I care about this. I think people walk around with a kind of low-level depression, actually, or at least like a low-level shame, because we know and we can pretend we don't know, but we do know that we're ignoring things that matter a lot to us. I think people are confronted with the shame of meat more often than they know, and or more often than they're consciously aware of. And it is just a profound relief. It is like one of the great reliefs in my life. I should say I've become a vegetarian maybe a dozen times or two dozen times. Mark Twain said that quitting smoking is the easiest thing in the world to do. He's done it 20 times. Becoming a vegetarian is also very easy in that way. My dietary choices have swung really quite with frequency and to extremes. But when I have become a vegetarian, and when I became a vegetarian the last time, which was the definitive time, it was just a huge relief. Like, it's not like I felt no triumph over anything. I felt not even exactly pride. I just felt the relief of being able to be closer to myself. You know, I think our selves, and this is true of everybody, we don't like violence. We don't like unnecessary violence, at least. We don't like unnecessary suffering. We don't like unnecessary destruction. And having to, on a daily basis, support violent suffering and destruction with our money, having to consume literally the flesh of it and incorporate it into our bodies, like, we pay a price for it, even if it's not overt, even if it's not something that keeps us up at night. And I mean, this is one of these things that's easy. It's an easy experiment to conduct. You know, watch a video of a factory farm and learn some information about the environmental effects of factory farming. And at your next meal, don't eat those products and see how you feel. I just guarantee you will feel relieved. You'll feel a little bit better. It's not to say that you'll feel so much better that your life will change and you'll never eat them again. because most people, myself included, become distracted, or, you know, there are competing instincts. It's not just shame and relief. It's also craving, which is very strong for food. It's also wanting to feel a part of certain social contexts or cultural contexts, which is also very strong. Wanting to participate in not only wanting to create a story for yourself and those that come after you, but participate in the stories that came before you, which very, very often do involve meat eating. So it's complicated. But that feeling of relief isn't complicated. You know.
What you're really talking about here is the way this issue kind of speaks to questions of identity, of who we are. And when we make these decisions, we're not just talking about a political issue. We're in some ways kind of forging ourselves. And in some ways, I think that's a driving thesis through the whole book. And I'm wondering, you know, we began with that story about your grandmother in the first chapter, which you call storytelling. And the last chapter in the book is also called storytelling. And I'm wondering if I could have you read that last part of the book, the very last page on 267, and maybe say something about why this issue is different. Not all moral issues rise to the level of identity the way you're talking about. What is it about this that makes that happen?
This is in the context of, I'm talking about Thanksgiving. And the first Thanksgiving when I would be cooking for our family and setting the table and deciding what's there. And Thanksgiving is such a symbolically potent holiday, and so much about storytelling that it felt appropriate to end it there. Historians tell a story about Abraham Lincoln, that while returning to Washington from Springfield, he forced his entire party to stop to help some small birds that he saw in distress. When chided by the others, he responded quite plainly, "I could not have slept tonight if I had left those poor creatures on the ground and not restored them to their mother." He did not make, though he might have, a case for the moral value of the birds, their worth to themselves or the ecosystem or God. Instead, he observed quite simply that once those suffering birds came into his view, a moral burden had been assumed. He could not be himself if he walked away. Lincoln was a hugely inconsistent personality, and of course he ate birds far more often than he aided them. But presented with the suffering of a fellow creature, he responded, "Whether I sit at the global table with my family or with my conscience, the factory farm for me doesn't merely appear unreasonable. To accept the factory farm feels inhumane. To accept the factory farm, to feed the food it produces to my family, to support it with my money, would make me less myself, less my grandmother's grandson, less my son's father. This is what my grandmother meant when she said, 'If nothing matters, there's nothing to save.'" So the question is, why does this particular issue rise to that large?
Yeah, I think if someone's a conservationist, they may value land, but somehow we don't walk around saying, "Oh, I'm a person who conserves land." But we do use this label. I'm a carnivore. I'm an omnivore. I'm a vegetarian. It becomes part of our identity. So what is it about this issue that matters so much?
Well, I would start by saying I think we are right that it should matter that much, but we might be wrong that it becomes so embedded in our identity. You know, that we do walk around and say, "I'm a carnivore, a vegetarian." If instead we had a relationship to it that was more similar to the environmentalists' relationship to the environment, I think we'd see a lot more people acting on their beliefs, these shared values, because we've accidentally created this dichotomy of, you know, people who care and people who don't care. You are a vegetarian or you're not. And the middle ground, which I think most Americans would be very happy to occupy, has become a place for hypocrites. You know, like, well, you know, meat is murder or it's not. And if it is, you shouldn't engage in that. And if it isn't, then you should engage in it as much as you want, as opposed to the more complex and I think sophisticated understanding of it, which is we don't know exactly what's going on. We don't know exactly what animal experience is like. We don't know exactly what happened to that specific animal. on that specific farm. We don't know what that farm is like. We don't know how it was transported from its life to its death. We don't know the particular health effects of eating that piece of meat. We don't know, you know, the economic system in which that particular piece of meat was raised. We don't know a million details that might feel necessary for us to know in order to make a really definitive decision. And we certainly will never have enough information to make a definitive decision over the course of our lives. So instead we make wagers, you know, and those wagers depend on who we are, how much energy and time we want to invest in these problems. I find that, you know, I think of myself as someone who eats as little meat as possible, and the amount is zero. I find it possible to eat none. You know, I find it actually quite easy. I know other people find it much more difficult to refrain from eating meat, but it may be that we are actually approaching it in identical ways. As people who want to reduce the amount of suffering in the world, reduce our participation in the suffering, reduce the amount of environmental destruction, and so on. So one of the things I wanted to do with this book was expand that middle ground and create it, present it as an attractive place to inhabit rather than a disappointing or dispiriting one, to be a place of inspiration rather than shame. You know, I think the meat industry is very happy for this dichotomy to exist. They're very happy for PETA to stand on street corners with meat is murder signs, because those signs are like a light switch. It's on or it's off. It can't be anywhere in the middle. Whereas our ethical lives are more like spectrums. You know, think about any other ethical realm, like truth-telling, for example. I'm somebody who likes to tell the truth. You're somebody who likes to tell the truth. I also happen to be somebody who tells lies occasionally, you know, and you're such a person as well, I assume. But it doesn't mean that, you know, the example I think I give in the book, if I'm remembering correctly, is my mother comes down the stairs, asks me if she looks nice in a dress. I say, yeah, you look great. So, let's say she didn't actually. I said it because it was the nice thing to say, it was the right thing to say, it was an innocent lie, and the truth might have come at a great expense. It doesn't mean that after saying it, I take every available opportunity to tell lies. That doesn't make any sense. It hasn't been undermined, my desire to tell the truth, you know? And yet, how many times have I met a former vegetarian who, when you ask, oh, why did you stop? They say, oh, I was at an airport at 11:30 one night, and the only thing that was open was the Kentucky Fried Chicken, and I was literally shaking. I was so hungry. I thought I was going to have a whatever, an attack, and so I decided I would eat the chicken, and that was the end of it. And you're like, well, it doesn't make any sense. But it makes perfect sense if you think about these questions in terms of an all-or-nothing identity. And, you know, if you were to ask, do I think that half of all Americans will be vegetarian in 10 years, I would say there's virtually no chance of that. If you were to ask me, will half of all meals consumed in America be vegetarian in 10 years, I think there's a very good chance of that. But it will require shifting our perspective from a kind of identity that, when examined closely, starts to look like vanity more than something like a desire to participate in the betterment of the world, a movement from that towards something that is a bit more humble, a bit more flexible, a bit more appreciative of how complicated the world is, a bit more appreciative of how messy it is to be a human being, a bit more forgiving of our shortcomings, which will also look like a very strong desire to engage with these incredibly profound problems that we all feel strongly about but are too often afraid to approach because of the shame that's at stake.
Well, you've really, I think, helped us address those, so thank you so much. Do we have time for questions? Are we able to do so? There should be... So I believe we have some folks with mics in the audience will be the folks who actually call on you. We will not be doing that.
Hi, thank you both so much for being here. Mr. Foer, you mentioned that a large impetus for this book was explaining to your son about, you know, where food comes from. Is he a vegetarian, or what's his journey with that been?
Where's the person who's asking? I can't see. Okay, is he a vegetarian? I actually have two sons. One is 7 and a half, one is 4 and a half, or 7 3/4, and 4 3/4, as they would say. they're both vegetarians. It was funny. My older son accidentally ate chicken not that long ago. He had ordered something, and it came with chicken, and he ate it, and then he realized it was chicken. And he said, now I really can't understand the argument for eating meat because it tastes exactly like fake chicken. That was what he said. It just tastes exactly like fake chicken. So, you know... People often ask me two questions about that. One is, how do you explain to them that they're different? And two, what's going to happen when they decide they want to eat meat? So to the first question, it requires no explaining, no explanation that we have a dog that we treat in this way. We have stuffed animals. We have children's books, that almost all of which feature animals as heroes. And we don't kill and dismember animals and eat their bodies. That is so entirely unconfusing for a kid to understand. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with how right or wrong the act of eating meat is, but it makes it very easy to be the parent of a vegetarian. You know, I think meat eating, if it is explained not with averted eyes, but with a direct gaze, it might not require lying, but it definitely requires a story that is inconsistent with the other stories that children are told. It is out of place in the world of like a child's existence. What would I do if they want to eat meat one day? I'm not sure they ever will, because their feelings about it are so strong. They're quite a bit stronger than mine, actually. Their instincts are stronger than mine. But if they do, that's fine. I don't really care. I'm not interested in, first of all, I'm completely uninterested in any kind of like purity. I think that that is vanity and has nothing to do with like participating in like fixing these problems. And it may very well be that satisfying a curiosity makes it that much easier to participate in fixing the problems. But also, I don't want to create a little ethical replica of me. I want to help him to become someone who acts on his beliefs, who doesn't avert his gaze, who will risk hypocrisy, you know, in the interest of nudging the world closer to what it ought to be. So he might come to just a different understanding of the system, as have a lot of people who I really respect. You know, there are people who have very different solutions than mine to the problem of factory farming, but they acknowledge it's a problem. I guess if you were to ask me, if he didn't acknowledge that factory farming was a problem, would you be disappointed? I would be disappointed. But I imagine that you know, our opinions about things will diverge in many, many places.
Hi, thanks for coming and for speaking so articulately on this topic. I became a vegetarian when I was 13 after reading Diet for a New America. And the only argument that I have found persuasive since, in the past 2 decades, is the importance of supporting farms that are raising animals ethically and humanely. So I was just wondering if you could speak to that point.
That's an argument for what? For eating meat?
Yeah, in the favor of putting your dollars toward those farms that are actually doing the right thing. I've struggled with that.
And that might be a little bit like an argument for supporting, you know, a factory that treats its child laborers especially well. You know, like, you know, we can imagine a situation in which child labor is a good thing. We actually can imagine that, you know, in which, like, a young person who has really no other hope in the world of getting together enough money to eat a meal. Like, we can imagine that. It's not impossible to imagine. And an employer who treats the kid well and, like, doesn't overwork him and asks him to do only things that would be appropriate for a kid to do. We can imagine that. But we don't design systems around the exceptions. We design systems basically around what we imagine the lowest common denominator will be, or the worst case scenario. And animal farming on a global scale might possibly have made sense. It actually certainly made sense at various points in human history. But with 7 billion people on the planet, with China and India starting to eat like Americans, with dwindling environmental resources, with the like terror of contemporary animal engineering, and with what has been, I guess it's been demonstrated to be a kind of unlimitedly dark imagination of farming corporations, it's just not something, it's not a business I want to get involved with. I am both capable of saying a farmer like Frank Rees or Bill Nyman is a good person doing good things, giving animals good lives. There is just no denying that those animals have good lives. That doesn't necessarily, in fact, it certainly doesn't mean that it's a system that I want to get excited about. And when more than 99%, more than, I believe, 99.5, 0.6% of the animals that are consumed in America come from factory farms, what would it say of you to be a really ardent endorser of the remainder? You know, to be devoting your money to that. It will never supplant factory farming. It never, ever will. There's enough ethically raised chicken in the entirety of the United States to satisfy the chicken eating habit of the people of Staten Island. You know, so we simply don't have enough land to raise the amount of meat that people want to eat, and everybody knows that. There is nobody who doesn't know that. So there are a couple futures we could choose between. You know, we could have skyscrapers of animals, which we already have. You know, in Japan there are confinement units that are stacked 16, 20, 23 cages high. You know, we could have that. We could agree to have no fish left in the oceans, as fishery scientists now say we will have within a generation. Not no tilapia, not no salmon, no fish, no wild fish, zero fish. Our grandchildren would not know what wild fish were. You know, that's a future we could all agree to accept. We can agree to pass the costs on to our children and grandchildren. There was a study done after Eating Animals was published that tried to quantify the environmental costs of a McDonald's hamburger, a $1 hamburger. And it came to a number slightly north of $200. That's a real number. That's not a hypothetical or something. It's imaginary. It's imaginary in the sense that no one in this room will pay it, but it's real in the sense that our grandchildren will. So we are the last generation of humans who can, or we are not among the last generation of humans who could claim ignorance. You know, we are the generation of whom it will be asked, what did you do when you learned about these things? What was your response to these videos, to this information, to these op-eds that seem to be published like once a week in the New York Times about the 76 million cases of food poisoning that the CDC says factory farming is responsible for, the environmental destruction the UN says that factory farming is one of the top two or three causes of every significant environmental problem on the planet, locally and globally, from air pollution to deforestation to loss of biodiversity. It produces more greenhouse gas emissions than everything else on the planet put together. And it's just unspeakably cruel. one doesn't have to love animals. I actually don't love animals, curiously enough. You know, the first stop that I made in my research was to this place called Farm Sanctuary because I thought it would be a good idea to spend some time with pigs and cows. I'd never really done it in my life. And I couldn't wait to leave, to be honest. It was not something I wanted to do. But you don't have to love an animal to say that there are some ways we shouldn't treat them. You don't have to love a pig to say a pregnant pig shouldn't be kept in a cage so small that it can't turn around for the duration of its pregnancy. You only have to have baseline human decency. You don't have to be to ride on a ship that shoots torpedoes at whaling vessels with, you know, Greenpeace to say some things are worth preserving. We are in such an extreme situation with animal farming that you only have to believe that some things are worth preserving, that the air is worth preserving, that the water is worth preserving, that baseline human dignity in relationship to our treatment of animals is worth preserving, to want some kind of change, to want to refrain, to eat differently. You know, there are a lot of huge problems in the world. This is definitely one of them. The difference between this, what makes this one exceptional, is that its solution doesn't require trillions of dollars, doesn't require the election of a new government, doesn't require anyone to go to war with anyone. And it doesn't require us to find a new system of values. It only requires us to act on the values that we already have. And the acting is utterly simple. It's so simple. It's simpler than going to the gym. You know? All it requires is just pausing when you look at a menu or when you're putting things from the supermarket shelf into your cart and just saying for a second, you know, is this what I really want? When I take the full measure of my wants, is this what I really want? And if that pause could be replicated across this room, across this city, across this country, a few times a day, then radically rewriting our future would suddenly feel possible.
We have a question on your left.
The reason why factory farming has taken hold is because most people nowadays, especially in developed countries and urban areas, really don't have much contact with nature. They live mostly indoors.
Most people don't have access, don't have interactions with animals, you're saying?
Or nature
itself. I'm sure that that's a problem, and I think that, you know, dogs and cats, which are in the majority of American homes, are some response to that problem. I don't think it's true. You know, it might be the case that if we had more exposure to farms and to farming, to farmed animals and to farmers, that we would feel differently. But I think most people have more than enough information. I don't think it's a lack of information. You know, as I said before, the reason nobody wants to watch a PETA video, and the reason, I can't tell you how many times I've been in a bookstore and seen somebody pull this book from the shelf, look at the back of it, and put it back on the shelf. I mean, the title alone is usually enough. Because people know what it's going to be about. It's because people know. People already know. The challenge is not to inform people, it's to find ways that feel good to act on what we already know and what we already believe.
We're going to take our last question up here on top.
As a vegetarian for more than 30 years, I must confess that I've killed and murdered many, many plants. I've also wear leather shoes. So is it because I'm unsensitive to plants? Or what makes us think that we're... I find your argument a little bit moralistic. I find that vegetarianism is just a choice, a simple choice. And so I'm a little bit concerned about the moralistic vein of your exposure.
Well, first I'd ask what's wrong with being moralistic. I mean, we could say that it doesn't matter what anybody does. We could say that what you do is entirely your business and not mine. But I wouldn't want to live in that world. I would prefer to live in a world in which there's a very active conversation about our beliefs, particularly when our beliefs diverge. I became a vegetarian because of somebody who was, you might call moralistic, But I thought of as just open and honest about the choices that he made in his life. Now, I don't know if you're being serious or not when you wonder about the murder of plants. I will give you the benefit of the doubt and assume you're serious. What's that? You actually are serious. Okay. What reasons would you have to think that a pig suffers? You would have a lot of reasons, a whole lot of reasons. You would have the things we talked about before, you know, the fact that it goes to great lengths to escape suffering, the fact that it makes noises that are very familiar to us, the fact that its brain is doing things that are very familiar to us. We don't have any good reasons to think that plants suffer. They don't have brains. They don't make attempts to escape suffering. They show us nothing. Is it conceivable that plants suffer? I suppose it's conceivable. It's also conceivable that humans don't suffer. It is conceivable that you were not being serious when you asked your question. I am choosing to give you the benefit of the doubt because I think it's a better way to be in the world. I actually could have made fun of your question. That would have been very easy to do. But it's a more interesting life and it's a better life to take you seriously. So we are faced with the same choice in a million different ways, not only with food animals, but and not only with people. We can choose to have a generous interpretation of the information that we have. That's not to say everything matters, because we have information that suggests that some things matter than other things. We have a lot of information, a huge amount of information that suggests, not only a huge amount, as with each passing day, we are given more reasons to believe that the animals that we eat have some kind of rich experience of life. That isn't the case with vegetables. We have no reason to believe it. There's no, as time passes, we're not given any more reason to believe it. So, as with every decision we make in life, we're informed, and then the information reaches a limit, and we're left with our instincts, our values, our priorities, and mine have led me to the choices that I make. As I say at the end of my book, there's a difference between the choices you make in your house and the choices you endorse in the world or the things you expect of others. My best friends aren't vegetarians. I have most of them. I have no problem with that. And they have no problem with me. It's not a point of contention. They don't find me to be annoying, and I don't find them to be annoying. This book, despite the fact that my personal conclusion was vegetarianism, isn't actually a case for vegetarianism. It leaves an awful lot of room for different kinds of what's sometimes called like ethical meat eating. So not only do we make these particular choices in our life, our own lives, but we make choices about the reach of those choices. You know, a certain kind of choice has a reach that extends only actually to my skin. And then there's a kind of choice that extends to my children. And then there's a kind of choice that extends to the kind of book that I would write. And then there's a kind of choice that extends to how I respond to the kind of question that you asked.
So I think we'll need to end there. Thank you so much, Jonathan.